Now, stay tuned. We have the Dr. and Mrs. Future Show coming up right here on KSCO. Welcome back, my friends, to the show that never ends. Ladies and gentlemen, KSCO presents the Dr. Future Show. If you would like to join in our show today, you can call us at 831-479-1080. That's 831-479-1080. And now, your host, Dr. Future.
Good afternoon, everyone. Good afternoon, Mrs. Future.
Good afternoon.
Good afternoon, Bobby.
Good afternoon. What a beautiful day.
Isn't it? It's really nice here, too. It's like springtime.
Yeah.
You have sunny weather there?
Oh, absolutely. I mean, clear blue skies. It's like a perfect day. It's amazing.
Yeah. That's San Francisco in the spring. Really nice.
Yeah.
Wonderful. Good. And we'll get some exciting news today. I want to start off with what everyone has been paying attention to, that the NASA and the Mars Perseverance
The absolute historic landing of the rover on Mars.
We all had quite some time enjoying that.
Yes.
Watching that. I gather you watched it live as well, Bobby, eh?
Yeah, that was incredible. Yeah, that was great. I mean, and, you know, the delay time was very short this time. You know, it's only 12-minute delay. And but everything was successful.
And Mrs. Future, remember, we watched it on the big screen. We brought it up and...
Yes,
oh, really?
We were all over the live broadcast. In fact, we watched the virtual world webcam that was going on.
That's right. They had a 360 camera in JPL facility, and we did that.
Yeah.
And to cover it in even more detail, we have, I believe, on the line Dr. Bruce Damer, who has been part of the Origin of Life research involving our
landing. And who helped pick the rover's exploratory sites, I believe. Yeah. How are you, Bruce?
I'm wonderful, Dr. and Mrs. Future.
All right. Did you watch it as well? I imagine you must have been quite excited.
Yeah, David Deemer, my colleague at UCSC, he came over to the Gandalf House, and we had a wonderful Perseverance Percy landing party.
Oh, and fantastic.
Awesome. That's what you call the Perseverance Percy?
They're calling him her... Percy, exactly.
Yeah, yep. Jessica, the mission scientist, calls it a her. The other people don't really genderize it too much, that I've noticed.
That what do they call this? 7 minutes of terror is what some people call it.
It's another Rob Manning special. He's the original architect of the EDL, the Entry, Descent, and Landing for Pathfinder and for Opportunity and Spirit, and now for Curiosity and Percy, his sky crane design. It was a team effort, but Rob Manning is to be credited for that.
Yeah, they must all feel like proud parents after, you know, the fifth kid is born, right?
Yeah, it's 5-0 for success for that team.
Yeah.
So everything worked perfectly?
Really perfectly. When I was involved and I was an observer, I was sort of a participant observer at the Spirit and Opportunities landing site selection, and part of that, we had this huge spreadsheet which showed all the steps that would happen during EDL. And this time we had it on screen, and you could actually see the different technical steps as they raced toward the surface. And it was just, those are familiar terms for me. Some of those are from the spreadsheet.
Yeah, I remember that. They had the whole steps as it was approaching. The thing to keep in mind is this was completely autonomous.
Yeah, and so is a lot of the driving as well. And in Mars rover language, the rover has to learn how to surmount or circumvent. So when it starts driving, it either goes over rocks or winds its way around them, so that you're not actually live driving. You're telling it, drive 100 meters, and it just takes itself the most safe course.
Yeah, I guess that's because it takes 13 minutes for us to send a command from Earth to reach there.
Yeah, sometimes 20 when Mars is further away. So you do what's called an uplink, and then you see the results.
Hmm. Now, the rover is communicating with a satellite in orbit?
Multiple satellites. So one of them was within the window and caught those first images, reflected those first images off so fast, you know, because if you remember the Viking landers in 76, it was quite a while before we got those TV images to come in and
Yeah, it was like everything. One line at a time.
Right. You remember that, Al?
Yeah, I sure do. Yeah, and J.J. Webb, one of our friends in Boulder Creek, had helped design the lenses for that spacecraft.
How wonderful. Gosh. And,
yeah, we have a little piece that he put together for Yuri's Night a few years ago. I reposted that on Facebook.
And, that is wonderful.
It was quite an effort to get the first land. I often wondered how they landed that craft. That looked like a pretty big craft.
That was straight propulsive descent. So there was, of course, a shell, and there was a chute. But then it was basically like the sky crane for Percy. It was just a sky crane landing on its own propulsion.
Kind of like the way the Elon Musk is landing his boosters.
Yes, yeah. So, and it wasn't, Perseverance was a rover, which, you know, isn't sort of designed to carry around little rocket motors, so it made sense to unspool it from some other contraption, and that flies away and crashes.
Mm. I was impressed with the number of cameras they seem to have on board this one.
And a microphone.
Yeah, and a mic, right.
Just today they posted the first sort of windy sounds from Mars, very thin atmosphere.
Yeah, I heard that. I was thinking whether or not that would be good for radio here, but from what I heard, it sounded like like one of my microphones on a windy day outside, but not, you know, so it didn't sound particularly impressive.
That's probably all that they'll ever pick up.
Really?
Unless it's a dust devil. If a dust devil is coming over, it'll pick up, like out at Burning Man when we had those dust devils.
Now, that would be something. I think one of the things they said, well, what can you use a microphone for on Mars? They said, well, I guess you could listen to the rover and hear if it's squeaking too much in one wheel, or noises often are very diagnostic, have the diagnostic value.
They had to beef up. When we were at the landing site team meetings, I was at two, third and fourth landing site. They actually had a wheel from Percy on display, and it's so larger and the metal on it so thicker because Curiosity's wheel's been getting torn up by rocks.
So that could be very useful for that. What about infrared? Do you know anything about the infrared cameras or what they're going to use those for?
I do not. I actually didn't study the instruments on this mission as carefully. I was mainly involved on choosing. It was a long process, a four-year process of choosing where to go. And Jezero Crater was always a high candidate. We were part of 16 landing sites and whittled down to 8, and then we were in the top 3. We were the Columbia Hills team arguing that we should go back to where Spirit found an ancient hot spring preserve in the rocks.
Yeah. Jezero was the one that won, and perhaps you could tell us more about that and how they're going to look for life there, but we need to go to a commercial break.
Okay,
we'll be right back. We're talking to Dr. Bruce Damer about the origins of life on Mars. We'll be right back. Welcome back to the show. Yeah, we're talking to Dr. Bruce Damer about the Jezero Crater landing spot for Perseverance, or Percy, as she has become affectionately known as. Now, Bruce, Jezero Crater, I guess after looking at more than 60 candidate locations and choosing that one, it must be a pretty good option for looking for life.
It is and it isn't. There's competing interests in all these landing site selections. You only have one rover. So there's a group that wants to look at the history of Mars from a geologic perspective. Mm-hmm. There's a very big group that wants to go to new places. But there was a relatively small group that understood what you're looking for when you're looking for what are called biosignatures.
Yeah.
When on Earth, what we do is we go to rock outcrops that are pretty much intact. Look for rocks that maybe, what are you calling, siliceous rocks or with silica, made with silica. If they're associated with old hot springs, they generally preserve microbial textures called stromatolites, or even microfossils are preserved, and organics are preserved in this. And so if you're at a river delta, you have a problem because you've got a jumble of materials, like a Jezero Crater is a big river outwash delta. The argument for Jezero as the rover drives to the foot wall of this delta is that you've got lots of material and different ages as it climbs the foot, you know, of the delta.
But I guess it's washing material from quite a distance
from
away.
Other places.
Yeah.
But lots of bang for the buck in terms of different eras you can study.
Definitely. But the challenge is if we go to a place like that on Earth, like in Australia, where we go in the Pilbara, if we go away from the outcrops, the 3.5 billion year old outcrops, and we go toward an old sort of outwash river delta of the same age, we won't find any fossil evidence. We won't find any preserved organics. We won't find stromatolites. It's just it's really difficult. So they're actually going to a place that doesn't have good biopreservation potential.
Mm. So they would be looking at the shoreline sediments, wouldn't they, to see if there's anything in those?
Yeah, the challenge is, of course, you're overlaying with millennia or billions of years of material, and it's all been heavily irradiated. Mm. And so the organics have long since broken down, and the weathering has, as the outwash delta just lays down material, the weathering has broken down evidence, and the evidence is probably largely buried deeply anyway. So one of the things they're going to look for is just any signs of compounds that in mudstones, which would occur there, you know, in a lake environment, that might have organic material that are indicative of life, past life. Mm. But it's a needle in a haystack.
Now, are they looking, you said mudstones, do they have a list of things that they'll be roving for, they'll be specifically looking for?
Definitely. I mean, Curiosity found mudstones in the crater, the lake area that it is, where they're climbing Mount Sharp now. But they found all these crusty salts, and they found these mudstones with clear sort of organic components. Now, those organic components could come from any source. They don't necessarily mean life, or organic in this case doesn't mean life. It means carbon-based compounds, which have multiple sources in geology and including infall material from asteroids and things like that.
Mm. Is there any chance they might find actual remnants of microbes, or is it just fossilized forms of life?
There's no way to find remnants of microbes because you'd have to find just the right rock, ship it back to Earth, and do thin sectioning and look under microscopes, which the rover can't do. Mm. So the rover's collecting these core samples that hopefully at some point in the mid-30s probably, or even later, they'll have a sample return. We'll pick up this cache of core tubes.
Boy, that's a slow FedEx.
It's very slow. It's not
well, it's really fast
either,
for interplanetary, though. You can't beat it.
They've just now restarted to look at the mission to do that, and it's multi-stage and multi-billion dollars, and it's tough. So last year, in a meeting at another space agency, a group of us met and designed a very, very lightweight sample return mission where you don't have a rover, you have basically small copters, just like the one on Percy. Where
Ingenuity?
Mm. Yeah, that's another pretty interesting little thing, too. That's the first time that we'll have a aircraft flying on another planet.
Yeah, and it's a prelude to Firefly going to Titan, which has a thick atmosphere. Ah. And so that mission's going to be tremendous. It's years in the future. But Ingenuity, one of the things to understand, unlike your drones, Al, and your drone collection, Ingenuity's blades are a meter across, and they're spinning at some very, very high RPM because the atmosphere is only 1% of Earth. So
thin.
It's a big thing. I mean, it's not a, it's sort of at the edge of being able to fly on Mars.
Sure. We needed to copy the hummingbirds, right?
I heard when they're testing it, they're going to try to move the rover a fair distance away from it to keep the dust down around the rover.
Yeah, and to keep it from having an accidental collision.
Yeah, last thing you want.
It's what's called a technology demonstrator, and it was added pretty last minute. At the meeting, I think around the fourth landing site meeting, it was announced they were going to add it.
So
it was a really late add-on.
Yeah. I guess it's not so much a scientific mission as it is a proof of concept to see if we can indeed fly a craft on another planet.
Yeah. It's called, these technology demonstrators. And then who knows, in some future mission, there may be multiple ones. The design I came up with was called Origami Swarm, and it was small copters that would be released into the atmosphere that would weigh just a few ounces
mm-hmm.
and would be able to go into powered flight as they approached the surface. So there was no lander. And then those would have little clamps on the end that would pick up very, very small samples and centrally cache them in a rice bowl, a return dish.
So that's pretty fancy.
Yeah, I'd like to see that, YouTube.
came up with that in Japan at a Japanese space agency meeting. And it was just a notional idea, but it's another type of sample return where use super lightweight things to collect known samples at Columbia Hills.
The mini grains of rice model.
Mini grains of rice. And the samples are like a gram each. And we just don't need that much. We don't need to drill. We know exactly the kind of opaline silicate rocks we're looking for to get back. And then, of course, you have to have a launcher and a return vehicle. It's complex in anyone's book.
Now, going back to the craft that's there now, it's fairly complex in its own right, right, in terms of the availability of what it can do. But what about analyze? Does it have any laboratories on board, do you know of?
It does. It has a suite associated with the sample collection tray. It has a suite of tools to do, especially a lot of imaging, heating, and really good, because of the digital revolution, we've got superb instruments, cameras and external imagers and internal imagers. And we can use a laser to puff material off the rock and do a spectrum analysis on that material.
Yeah.
And of course, the first time a microphone is being used in the mix.
Yeah, that's what we're talking about. Yeah, and hopefully they'll get something interesting with it.
Yeah, it's definitely a really good mission that is very exciting. My only comment is it's really not primarily a life detection mission because it is going to a site where it's going to be challenging. However, our colleagues did tell us there's evidence of opaline silica, which is indicative of hot springs that could be found in that area or on the extended mission. They were listening to us, and I think on the extended mission, after they finish the crater, they're going to try to drive to a place called Midway. Wow. Which was another possible landing site. If it's still going and it's even past its warranty, they're going to try to drive to Midway.
Yeah, okay, Midway, which they might find some signs of life there.
The retirement vacation on Mars.
Now, does that mean there's a hot springs there or possibly?
Well, all along, Spirit found a hot spring, evidence of an old hot spring by accident by dragging a broken down wheel.
Yeah.
It turned up this white powder, so it only discovered it by accident. So,
so
Percy could also be looking for something like that and find something, because there's evidence of hot springs all over Mars and volcanic activity.
Well, I understand they have a FLIR camera on board, so they'll be looking for heat signatures coming from the planet. So that if there was still a real hot spring still alive there, they might be able to detect that.
And the fun part is we put this proposal forward that if life began on a hot spring in Mars, as Mars lost surface habitability, the life would escape in the plumbing down into the rocks for safety as the atmosphere went away. And then occasionally hot water comes up through the hot springs. It would bring evidence for life up to the surface much later than around its origins. Even a few hundred million years ago, the upwelling would bring, like the jacuzzi would form temporarily and there would be a microbiota in there.
And they'd be reactivated by the spring. And what's your thought on the idea that the life on Earth is connected to the life on Mars if we did find any? Do you think that
it's a fascinating hypothesis? It could be that life started earlier because Mars cooled and was stable with liquid water before Earth was.
Yeah.
It's conjecture. It's not really.
And not until we find something that indicates what's there that we won't know.
If we have to find a living organism and sequence its DNA and see if it has the same genetic code.
Yes.
And then we would say, well, it was a double origin. It could have originated on Mars or on Earth and just through this sort of idea of panspermia gone back and forth. But if it had a really alien kind of a DNA, then we'd say, well, we have two separate origins probably.
Yeah. So it all depends on what
we find. That would be clear. Yeah. It's fascinating. Question. It may take generations to, because we have to drill into rocks to find any evidence of living microbes.
Oh.
And get them. We have to get them back to Earth too. So it's decades away.
Right. Well, thank God we have some imaging equipment.
Yeah, it was interesting to listen to the mission crew describe how the end result of this mission is that they'll compile a pile of samples that is going to wait for a rocket to land to take the samples back someday.
Yeah, and it's challenging. It's super challenging because they have to get another rover on the surface, pick them up, put them into a launcher. The launcher has to get intercepted in Mars orbit, put into the capsule, then has to get deposited into Earth's atmosphere and come down. That's a lot
of steps in that elevator.
Yeah. Bruce, you have a couple of questions coming in. Is there any chance you could stay for another segment?
Oh, sure. Absolutely, yeah.
Okay, we've got to go to a break. We'll be right back. We're talking to Dr. Bruce Damer about the Jezero landing spot and what we might find there on Mars.
So here's some sponsors who love this station, and we'll be right back.
Okay, welcome back to the show. We're talking to Bruce Damer about Perseverance on Mars, and we have Bobby Wilder, our science correspondent in San Francisco, on the line as well. And Bobby, feel free to ask Bruce anything while we have him.
Yes.
And I do have a question from George in Vallejo. Is it true that Mars lost its atmosphere and hence water, and will the Perseverance be able to tell us when that happened?
That's a really good question, and that's actually a value for going to Jezero Crater, because it gives you all these ages. So it's thought that Mars, the oldest period is called the Noachian, and the next oldest called the Hesperian. Mm. And it's thought that Mars had some kind of seas, liquid water, maybe a hydrosphere like rain and things like that into the Hesperian. Mm. But it's not sure how long. It was 500 million years or 700 million years, and then suddenly you're dealing with a dry, mummified planet, because they no magnetic field, you couldn't preserve your atmosphere from getting stripped off by solar winds. And so that's why Mars just became not habitable at the surface within about 15% of its age.
When was that in terms of our timeline? We started having life 4 billion years ago, 4.5 billion on this planet.
We have confirmed microbial communities at 3.5. We have some evidence at 3.7, and maybe some chemical isotopic evidence at 4. But Mars would have lost its habitability by 3 billion years ago, most certainly.
Mm-hmm. By 3 billion years ago. Okay, so there's just a short overlap where both planets could support life simultaneously.
Yeah, so a rock that was blown off the Earth landing on Mars in that period, there would be nowhere for life to go. And in fact, in the rover, inside the compartment, or sort of the body of the rover, there might be microbial biofilms that are dried out that are still alive, that if they were exposed to the exterior radiation, they would be gone. So there's no real risk of us contaminating Mars unless we put microbes where there was liquid water somehow.
Because we have this automatic radiation sterilization going on.
Yeah, and the soils are full of perchlorates, and that's life sterilizing too. So in the movie The Martian, there's no way you could have grown potatoes in that environment. It was kind of all made up stuff, you know.
It sure worked though, and made a lot of people who like potatoes very happy.
Yeah.
I got a question from Norm in Aptos here. If you discover something alive there, what is the protocol? Is there a prime directive? And will,
you know, there's...
Yeah, and are there exoecologists that would weigh in?
There are whole offices. You know, there's sort of an Earth Protection Office at NASA for sample return, and there's a whole protocol, but I think that given that what we're going to do is probably get some suggestion of organic biosignatures, but they won't be conclusive, which will be similar to Viking. If we manage to roll up to a rock that had these ripply textures in them, like the ones we find in Australia, it's stromatolites, and we're really in the money, because that's visible to cameras that are on the rover.
Stromatolites would be instantly observable if they were on the surface.
They would be if they're on the surface. And of course, everything is under a crust of dust. So you have to be able to chip away, and like we do in Australia, we take out our S-wing hammers and we bust away rocks and we look at the clean breaks.
Okay, well, this is what a citizen scientist could do here. They could go through the thousands of pictures NASA's sending in every day and see if they see some patterns that are worth looking for.
It could be you'd have to break into those rocks first. So that's a challenge. You'd have like a little hammer there.
Now, as I recall, the stromatolites that you and your team found here are evidence of the biofilm of the early life. Is that right?
Yeah, they're evidence of whole microbial communities. So when you're next to a really stinky pond with a muddy shore that's covered with all this goo, and part of that is microbial biofilms, and those sticky things leave grains of sand stuck in them, and then they layer up and they create the layers. And so we still see stromatolites forming today. And so that's kind of what we're looking. That's macro.
Well, could you describe what that would look like to in radio language, the theater of the mind here? What would that look like? Could you describe for the audience what it would look
like? Kind of looks like crinkly rocks, dome shapes of crinkles that go up and down. There could be pyramid shapes of crinkles. If you Google stromatolite, you'll see a zillion pictures of them.
Crinkly
and
rocks.
There's living stromatolites in the salty bays of Shark Bay, Australia, and a bunch of places that there's actually those things are still around. They look like rock towers coming out of the water.
So they're kind of oozy piles of pre-life.
Is it kind of like monolith?
Yeah, it's kind of like that, although that's a more of a, I don't know if they call those stromatolites, but they're things like that. The stromatolites of Shark Bay are like pillowy, spongy stuff of microbes, and under it seems to be rocks, but those rocks are made by life leaving terraces.
It's the kind of stuff that makes you cringe when you accidentally step in it by the shore?
A little bit, Mrs. Future. Yeah, absolutely. It's sort of, when I was in Australia for the first time, I pushed my finger into a stromatolite at the seashore, and then I found microbial biofilms called desert mats way inland, and I poured my water bottle on them and rehydrated them as though I was creating a rainfall event. And they had the same spongy feeling. And then I had the insight that life started at a hot spring further back, further inland, in a cycling hot spring. And this is what Dave Diemer and I have been working on for 10 years.
I'm sure that little stromatolite was very grateful that you shared your water.
Exactly, yes.
Now, is the real significance of stromatolites that they're the earliest fossil evidence of life on Earth?
They're some of the earliest macro evidence where you can actually see and study what were clearly large communities of organisms, of microorganisms. There are also little miniature preserved fossils in cherts and other kinds of rock. And then there's also stuff left over from life that's made by life in kerogens and things like this. So there's those really three types of evidence for really old life.
Now, weren't the stromatolites team up with some kind of bacteria to create oxygen, which went into our atmosphere? They created massive amounts of oxygen.
So those layered microbial biofilms, they're just emitting oxygen, bubbles of oxygen, even today. And that built up in our atmosphere and went to critical mass to allow oxygen-breathing organisms like us to make more energy and stand up and walk and go out for hamburgers.
So if we find stromatolite evidence there, we'd want to see what kind of bacteria might have lived with them to see what kind of gas they would have been pouring into the Martian atmosphere.
Yeah, and the challenge is, in Earth, you had a whole planet to conquer for these microbes. In Mars, if the planet's dying around you, how far does evolution get? Does it develop photosynthesis, or are they all chemical eating? Are they all underground? So the evolution kind of stops on a planet that's dying like that.
Yeah. One of our listeners, Sean, sent us a really great link that's in the Dr. Future show links today about the history of our solar system and in particular tracing the origins of water on Earth and doing a really great description of the early formation of Mars and Earth.
And where does water come from?
Yeah, and basically Mars was presented as a planet that was just barely in the Goldilocks zone of our heliosphere and is too small. It doesn't have the gravity that Earth does to hold the atmosphere and to create the magnetic field that allows us to protect our water and oxygen and nitrogen resources. And so Mars has just had a slow leak of its resources for millions, hundreds of millions of years.
Yeah, and Ms. Future, that points out that life can start on many planets, perhaps early on, but most of those planets cannot retain their atmospheres and their liquid water at the surface. Earth was an amazing, rare exception, and could have been the large moon or a bunch of other things that we had always had liquid water, sometimes frozen, but we always had liquid water, and it's not a given. Planets just don't naturally save their liquid water over time.
Yeah, and this series points out how rare it is when you think about how hot the stars are, and of course the area immediately around the stars, and how cold space is, and that range of thousands of degrees Fahrenheit. And here we are in a zone where we have the full range of water from frozen to gas, with liquid in the middle, all in one planet.
And here's another funny one for you. If you strip life of all Earth right now and said, can it start? We're out of the habitable zone. So if Earth was starting right now all from scratch, you couldn't start life here.
Really?
Oh, wow. Really? Are we too close or too far from the sun?
We're too far. You know, we would have dried out just like Mars. We would have maintained our atmosphere. But it's a strange thing that life probably extended our habitability just by the fact of the idea of Gaia theory, where life regulates its own conditions, on a planet-wide basis. But yeah, we're not really technically habitable anymore if we started over.
Well, so, not by the early microbes anyway, so but maybe not, by the current humans if we play our cards right.
We better not mess up this time.
And Venus's example of really messing up as a planet. You know, you're way too close to your star, and man, it's not pleasant.
I don't know. We bailed out Venus so many times. Stay there for a while.
Well, but according to that, Venus is still in the habitable zone.
She could be brought back, but you know,
yeah, she just needs the right combination of events to happen to reclaim the zone.
She's the closest, and I don't think Mercury has much life. But then the other side, there's Mars would be on the outside of the Goldilocks zone.
Yeah, Mars. It's really hard to estimate this, but as the sun gets hotter, which is gradually getting hotter, it'll turn into a red giant. It'll consume the Earth and probably all the way out to Mars. It'll just expand, and then suddenly the icy moons of Jupiter and Saturn will melt, and then suddenly there'll be kind of water worlds at the surface.
So that might be our next hop, huh? If we want to continue surviving as life forms, wherever we're at that point in time.
In 8 billion years, and then you've got a red giant, which is a different life source, and it's unstable, and... Man, it's getting complex life going, especially life with the Dr. Future shows, is a rarity. You may be the only Dr. Future show in the universe.
Yeah, well, at least we're going ahead on AM and FM, so there'll be an analog record of us hurtling out into space here. Bruce, we have another question for you. Can you hold on for another segment?
Sure, absolutely, yeah.
Perfect, okay. We're going to keep you on until 3 then. We'll give you the question after the break. I'll just give you a clue. It's from Richard in Long Beach. Okay, welcome back to the show. Richard in Long Beach, question. Bruce, do you think Elon will beat NASA to Mars with Starship before the sample return?
Now, that's a very good question. I predict that there are going to be many gotchas on the road to Mars for anyone, especially a private company that's attempting to do this.
So you're thinking it's going to take him longer than he's saying. He's talking about boots on the ground by 24.
I think that's unrealistic, of course.
Well, we know the next launch window is 2022, so we'll just see how many he crashes between now and
then. Well, he's got to send something up in 22. I mean, something's got to go up.
I think it's realistic for Starship to do like an orbit around the moon in this decade, even by 2025 or 2026. I think that's realistic, but
They're sending up tourists by the end of the year.
With Dragon,
Dragon, yeah.
It says Dragon's taken 10, 12 years to sort of flight ready. I mean, Starship is a new vehicle.
Right.
Well, you know, so his plan is to land a fully automated supply ship there with no people.
First.
That's the first Mars landing.
One of the good things about Percy, and you brought that up, Mr. Future, is that it's going to try to do an oxygen extraction from the atmosphere. So that'll be a test whether or not that supply ship or that manufacturing can make fuels for the return trip.
From the atmosphere.
coming from a mining family, my brother's in open pit mining. I did projects with Colorado School of Mines. I'm very skeptical about any automated piece of equipment processing material that's very dusty or processing rock and staying operational for any period of time.
No, I think that the logic is very different than that, Bruce. It's more like he's going to send Starship to be the airport there, and it may have the equivalent of a rover, but it'll be a launch vehicle that gets back up to one of the orbitals or something like that.
But it has to have fuel. So that's where it'll have no fuel. So that's where our Shepard project came in. You both remember the TEDx talk of five years ago. And that is to encapsulate asteroids in a fabric enclosure, increase the temperature, create an atmosphere around them, manage them,
and then
sublimate water, ice, water vapor from them and create fuel stations for Starship on the way. And I think when we've done something like that, when we've created these fuel depots, resupply depots, we're realistic about going to Mars.
Well, yeah, I see. The popular series, The Expanse, has a solar system economy, and they say that Mars, at least in this story, Mars used a lot of water from the asteroid belt from Ceres in order to populate itself.
Another challenge for Mars is there's a reason it's sterilizing on the surface. It's a hard vacuum. It's very dry, ultraviolet radiation. It's a sink. So in order to have Mars even barely habitable, you'd have to either dome your entire enclosure, pressurize it, and create a non-Mars atmosphere, or you'd have to hit Mars with a vast quantity of volatiles of water and things like this, and that would largely get absorbed in the sink pretty quickly. So you're kind of damned if you do, damned if you don't. Mm-hmm. So creating a huge infrastructure like a domed or buried enclosure is so enormously costly and risky that I think I would go with Jeff Bezos' approach, which is to build large mega structures in space, kind of like cruise ships.
Sure, Star Trek Enterprise. That makes more sense. And then Mars is really just sort of like a gas station on the way to the asteroid belt.
Right? Well, Mars has very few resources that will be usable. That's the problem. Asteroids themselves are the resources, just like it's shown in The Expanse. They're the gold mines. They're the full of water ice. They're full of organics, and they're full of metals.
Well, what I mean by that is that you can do a lot of orbitals around Mars that are set to handle missions that are on their way to the asteroid belt, and you can avoid the gravity well of Mars, but you can take advantage of the launch windows because it'll be kind of one of the super freeways of the solar system.
Yeah, precisely. And you create these way stations as well. I think The Expanse has those, and there's always Deep Space Nine had this space station at this the optimal place in space to stop in at and do all your training with the Ferengi.
Yeah, here we have Ceres. There's a Ceres station. There's Tycho station, Ceres, and Eros. Eros is Ceres and Eros are kind of worn down. They look like the train station in New York at 3 a.m.
Well, and they're like 3 generations of space inhabitants that can't come back to the Earth anymore because they've never grown up in gravity.
Right. Yeah,
that's right. Right.
And the belters control a certain amount of the resources in the system, and they have their own culture.
Yeah, they're like the miners, but you have the malevolent forces on Earth that are experimenting on them against their will.
Yeah.
Yeah.
And I think Bezos just funded it for the 5th season now. So
The Expanse.
Oh, that's fun.
Yeah.
It's really a great series. Just the way that they have.
It could be a lot more spiritual than it is. I think one of the problems is that everyone is still pretty much got Earth level spirituality. Mm-hmm. You know, when you're in a solar system, you're going to...
Yeah, it's an alien sci-fi series with a lot of military conniving going on, as opposed to something where there's elevated
It's crazy.
Evolution of humanity.
You know, it's great drama, though. It's great sentient monkey drama. It does bring up another interesting... people have been commenting about what does Elon mean by selling T-shirts reading Nuke Mars? What does he mean by that, Bruce?
What he probably means is, and this is an old idea, that if you can hit a planet with a huge mantle, like a crust-disrupting event, it will create a lot of gas emissions. Kind of like in Total Recall where he says, start the reactor. You know, that was to release all this gas and material to try to beef up the atmosphere, except it's going to give you a lot of very toxic stuff. And so
I see. I guess it was an idea to quickly get Mars an atmosphere. right? So really,
it would change the atmosphere. It may not give it a useful atmosphere for us or would, for life.
Yeah. Bobby, what do you think? You nuke Mars?
Well, I think we should take a look, see what's there that we're going to nuke first.
And you should definitely get the locals to vote on it.
Well, frozen water. Water. You get water into the atmosphere. You get carbon dioxide.
Yeah, you're again, it's probably going to have an inconclusive result. So I think it's Gerard O'Neill was correct in the 70s when he said that the surface of the moon or the surface of a planet in their solar system is not the best place to build the next civilization. It really is going to be these colonies, these structures that are purpose-built, flooded with energy, easily accessible, and of course the asteroids providing most of the materials.
Yeah, I see what you mean, Bruce. In a sense, it would be a lot easier, a lot less resource intensive than to go onto the surface of a planet. But it seems to me that we'd want to go to the surface of a planet as a sign of mastery of ecosystems. Like once know how to do it, we need to do it. You know, and Mars is like a blank slate for creating heaven on Mars.
Well, Mars is not like the Utah desert. It's worse.
It's the worst you can be. Right. It's we'd have to be really smart to be able to make it a living planet.
I think that we'll have research stations there, but kind of trying to do habitability. Life couldn't do it for 3 billion years, so what makes us think we can?
Well, I think Crazy
Monkeys.
Bruce, you and I, our favorite movie, Silent Running, has that space station where they've got an eco facility that's manned for the benefit of the planets. And when you're talking about the future of space, I do believe that the planets will be gravity navigation tools. And then what is in the space between the planets is going to be where our civilization on ships will be. So,
yeah, I think it's really going to be. I mean, we spent thousands of years learning how to build big apartment buildings, shopping malls, and cruise ships, and we kind of like living in those places.
That's true. So,
they're very efficient relative to living on your own in the jungle.
I'll tell you, if you get used to floating around in space, you're not going to want to go to a planet. You won't have to be able to handle the gravity, right?
Most places, I mean, the lunar surface is a terrible environment. It swings in temperature. It's a hard vacuum. It's really challenging. Surviving there is a real challenge.
Yeah, it would be the hardest thing we could ever do. Anyway, let's keep going on this in the near future.
This has been really fun.
We appreciate you being on the show. Thanks for sharing your wisdom on this. It's just beginning, really, this whole Mars adventure, and we look forward to hearing what else happens. Who knows? Maybe we'll discover a stromatolite with Perseverance.
We absolutely could get lucky. One could roll down Jezero Crater's footwall and present itself to the camera. Stranger things have happened in the past.
So if you want to be good citizen scientists out there, go to look up stromatolites and keep an eye open for those patterns from all those shots coming in from Mars.
Yeah, the future will not be like the past, but we might be able to learn something useful when we get there. Thanks so much, Bruce Damer, for talking with us.
Yeah. Appreciate your time, Bruce. And
thank you, Bruce. Welcome. That was very informative. Thank you.
See you next time.
All right, till next time.
All right, and Dr. and Mrs. Future and Bobby Wilder will be back after this break. If you want more information on stromatolites or anything Bruce Damer is sharing, Bruce, is that damer.com?
Damer.com is getting redeveloped. It's there, and you can Google Bruce Damer and you'll find it.
Now let's return for the second hour of the Dr. and Mrs. Future show right here on KSCO. And now, your host, Dr. Future.
Hello, everyone. Hello, Mrs. Future.
Hello, darling.
And Bobby, yes. San Francisco. Welcome.
Yeah.
So much to cover and so much good news.
Mm-hmm. Yeah.
Yeah, just amazing.
That's right.
But first, I'd like to say to Nick of Royal Oak that
we got your message on
the Sky Crane, and be happy to talk to you about the Sky Crane if you want to call back in. The Sky Crane is the craft that lowered the final few feet of the rover onto the surface of Mars. And it's an amazing machine. And it was a crazy idea to use a sky crane to lower this complex SUV-sized Martian vehicle. So pretty cool. I'm happy to talk about that. And I also wanted to mention that we started to speak about Elon and the Starship. Well, the Starship 10 might go up this week.
That's right. That's right. Oh, they might get it right this time. Third time's the charm in terms of test launches.
That's right. So much went so well until that last moment when it blew up.
Right.
But that was the final phase. That's
They're
a good
really
landing.
Getting a whole new concept in rocket re-landing, which is to let it fall and
belly
then rewrite
down.
Itself and then have that work for the landing.
Yeah, I mean, the last part works and you're fine.
It's brilliant if you can get it right.
Yeah. Now, if you could just stay on your belly, maybe that'd be the answer.
You want to say hi to Nick?
Hey, Nick. Thanks for calling back.
Thanks for your patience, Nick. We just had to give Bruce the stage there, but we are very interested in your thoughts.
Load of questions.
What's your question?
Benny's like 5.5 light minutes away, and it takes 12 minutes to come here? Is that
no, right? Not light minutes. No, 13 minutes.
Radio minutes.
Yeah, speed of light minutes. You say something now, or the KSCO signal, when you say something, goes out. 13 minutes later, someone on Mars will be able to hear you, and it'll take another 13 minutes to get back to you to respond.
Yeah.
It'd be a very different kind of conversation.
Yeah, really painful walkie-talkie.
That's why they invented text. Text,
they kicked up a lot. They kicked up a lot of dust, and I can be non-concerned about it. Well, that's the pretty penny. And hi, Def. I only get the nightly news, so it's still... this sky crane, it's out of my picture. Is it orbiting, relaying messages and things?
No, it was just a stage in the process of landing. It's a little rocket platform that stays still and lowers the rover onto the surface of Mars, and then it blows the cables using little charges, and it flies away and goes up and crash lands about a mile away or so.
Yeah, if you go onto a website like NASA.com or various websites that are tracking the mission, there are pictures that show you all of the components of the mission that have landed.
I'm still on Earth. I don't have that stuff. I was wondering, what kind of launch was it? Was it the heaviest weekend?
The heaviest ever. It's a big SUV.
Yeah.
Yeah,
is this like the heaviest load we can put up there?
Yeah,
so far.
Yeah, we couldn't do it. See, normally, we'd like the original Viking landers in the 70s, they would just land with the rocket blast going from the bottom, from just the main rocket blast, and it would land that way. And we could do that up to a certain heaviness. Lighter loads, like the Spirit and Opportunity, in the OOs, the early OOs, they put them in a giant inflatable
airbag.
Yeah, and it bounced around for a while until it stopped.
It's like a big soccer ball. And then they couldn't control
deflate,
where it was going to land.
Cut itself out, and I'm on a new planet. Yeah.
I'm glad we... So did you say we could land on a planet and go further into our galaxy faster than if we'd flown ourselves?
What did you say?
Well, say we could hitch a ride and get around the galaxy on Mars and take off again on the other side?
Oh, yeah. Well, we've talked about the idea of these gravity highways that go around the solar system, and that a lot of the calculations of when to launch a mission is an optimization between how close we are to the planet and how much oomph we can get from the relative gravity pulls of the planets that are between the beginning and the end of the mission.
They're like slingshots, yeah.
Okay.
Yeah, slingshots are part of it.
I'm part of the group that's just is so accomplished. It's grateful. And hopefully we don't, our resources are well met here.
Yeah.
And, the next thing is probably combining a couple of things in orbit and sending it off to the crater.
Mm-hmm. Yeah, I think so. I think we're going to find that there's going to be a whole lot of development between Earth and the Moon before there's a whole lot of development around Mars.
Yeah, no, you see,
because it's closer.
Mars is a serious fixer-upper. It's much nicer on Earth. But that's the point. That's the point, is that it is a fixer-upper. It's something that we could, if we really know our stuff, or we know how ecosystems work, we could build it so that it's a habitable planet. And it would prove a point, and we start with scratch and build it. It's more how engineers think rather than scientists. Scientists like to study things that are more complicated that we don't understand yet, while engineers will build things from scratch. And in this case, it's both, because Mars isn't starting from scratch, but it looks like it just might be life-free. And if so, we could create something magical there.
Oh, and one little bit of reassurance, Nick. 99.99% of the human-generated resources will still be invested in Earth. Only a little teeny tiny fraction of human potential is being invested in space. It just gets a lot of attention because it's so exciting.
There's so much concern about the dust. I'm not even concerned whether this space craft was deliberately put a living organ, spit on it. I don't care, the preparations of making it sterile is just out of mind.
Yeah, well, some people want to conserve things the way they are. Some people want to build something new. And everybody is going to have a chance to make their case as we go forward.
Yeah, again, watching all the dust kick up in high def is just, it's going to be neat when they get on the moon.
Yeah, I'm sure the rover is awfully glad that dust was cleared, much less to navigate
dust.
Now that it has a mission.
Well, you see, that's why partying at Burning Man and the dust is good training for Mars.
That's right. Yeah, future Martians have been
future
to
Martians
the burn.
Do dust really well, and you learn to be the dust at a certain point.
You got to go to a break.
Yeah. Okay, well, thanks for calling. We appreciate your attention.
Thanks, Nick.
Thanks, Nick. Oh, there's some other great breakthroughs on food. I got to tell you about this new food thing.
All right. Sounds yum. Be right back.
Welcome back to the show. Okay, now the food story is just, this is a multi-dimensional thing that involves several stories. But the first story in the food department is that the world's first 3D printed lab-grown ribeye steak was unveiled. I think many of you might have seen that in the headlines this last week. And it's huge. I think it will change the way we feed the planet.
I was asking a lifetime vegetarian recently what she thought about lab-grown meats, and she was all for it.
Yeah, there you go. See, no problem. As long as you can handle the ethical, I guess the only ethical dilemma would be involving the
life forms known as stem cells.
Known as stem cells of cattle.
That's true.
And I don't
think...
At
what point do you include cattle in the democracy process?
Well, you have to ask the smart cattle. And that probably wouldn't be ours. They're kind of raised this way. You have to go to the ones where they think of cattle as God, like India.
Oh, there you go. India, that's right. Right. We have to start with the Brahma cattle.
We're going to ask those cattle what's the...
And if they...
What's
if
their
they
wisdom
kind of,
on this issue?
If they bat their long eyelashes, we'll take that as a yes. Right.
Well, I think it's a multi-species thing. Now, did you know the cattle are very related to a water creature that we also have an affinity with? Dolphins.
Oh, that's right. The
ungulates.
Ungulates, they're called,
ungulates,
I think.
Yeah.
So, yeah, according to the Robin Williams special, when he went
to explore the connection, multi-species connection.
And he dragged a cow down to the ocean and tried to get it to go swimming to progenitors in the ocean.
Flossie, your ancestors made a choice, and I'd like you to make that choice with me again today.
Because it's time to play You Bet Your Species! Come on down! We're going in, we're going to lose the hooves and the horns and get a blowhole and fins! Your choices are stay on the land and have your teeth sucked by a metal machine or return to the open ocean! Yes, I see there's doubts, but look at the good side! You won't end up at McDonald's!
Aaron, look, it's warm! You'll swim free! You'll be able to breach and jump!
Okay, let's think about this again. You're right. That's why it takes 60 million years. It doesn't happen in one day. It takes a while. Maybe, you put a hoof forward one day. Another day, a hoof. Let's do it inch at a time.
Yeah, I know. I was trying to get the cows to talk to the dolphins. Wasn't a big... Those two don't party together very well.
No. It's kind of like us with the gorillas or something. We may have a lot in common, but we have a lot that's different now, too.
Yeah. Well, environments. What we need is the right environment. Yeah. For interspecies.
No, we need
play.
Bikinis for cows.
Yeah, to you, bikinis, huh?
Yeah. You think they should be covering up their udders?
Yes, they should.
Well, that's a lot of bikinis on one cow.
I don't know if you'd call it a bikini in that context.
It wouldn't be bi. It would be, what is it?
A bucketkini.
Put them on a surfboard.
How about a bucketkini?
On a surfboard.
A surfboard? Oh, for the cow to join the dolphins?
Yeah.
Yes. We can surf together.
Hey, yeah, can you surf together, drink fresh milk?
Well, again, I doubt that you're going to find much consent among the cows for this cockamamie human idea.
Yeah. Well, but they also, you see, they have the advantage, unlike our cows, they've been raised around monkeys, right? Because there's a lot of free monkeys in India.
Mm-hmm.
So the cows and the monkeys probably do have some kind of connection.
Mm-hmm.
The monkeys, at the very least, would ride around on the cows.
I'll take your word for it.
Okay. All right. Not that it matters to us here, but you never know.
Let's see. Got some other links here?
Yeah. So the idea
so we're talking about
that,
lab steaks.
Yeah. It's an Israeli company, Alf Farms. They've teamed up with the Faculty of Biomedical Engineering at Technion Israel Institute of Technology. That's like their MIT.
Mm-hmm.
And they cultivated lab-grown ribeyes using 3D bioprinting.
But I want to know if these lab-grown ribeyes have been vaccinated, because then I'm not going to eat them.
Which one? The Pfizer? Or you're more of a Moderna person?
You know, informed consent. I'm all for cruelty-free meat, but I'm not for stem cells grown in, I don't know, what is it, monkey brains?
Well, no. This
old fetuses?
No. The beauty of these steaks is that they're completely fresh.
Mm-hmm.
Like real steak, I mean, the animal has died some time ago.
Right.
So these are much fresher.
Yeah, these are living steaks.
Yeah, you grow it and
eat it. It sort of reminds me of a Doctor Who episode.
Grow it and eat it.
Torchwood. Wasn't there Torchwood where there was like a big vat whale or something that was like constantly being mined for living meat?
No, I don't remember that, but I wouldn't be surprised that Torchwood was something else.
Okay, so we eliminate cruelty, and at what price?
Free-range, slaughter-free ribeye.
That's right. And what makes it so much like a steak is that they're not just doing the heme part. They're not just doing the red blood cells. They're doing the fat cells as well, and they're marbling
very important.
It.
The vascularization, the thickness, the amount of nutrients flowing through it. Muscle and fat combo is the key.
Yeah. Yeah, so all those people who are fans of the Beyond Burger and the Impossible Burger, which I have to say we like them. They have become a regular part of our diet. So this is to kind of take it to the next level.
Yeah, I mean, 2018 was the first breakthrough. It was the first cultivated thin-cut steak.
Oh, like tartare.
Didn't really utilize the 3D printing, bioprinting at that point.
Mm-hmm.
And now to a full-blown ribeye.
Right.
Now, you see the choices of stem cells.
You used to have to scrape it off the Petri dish. Now you can cut through it.
Yeah. I've got a comment here. They gave the cows the Moderna vaccine.
Says who?
Says Richard in Long Beach.
Prove it. Send us a link.
I'll believe you.
You're just peanut gallering us.
Well, we'll find out. You know, it's not inconceivable that these vaccines had animal studies.
Okay. Well, that's true. They're very closely interwoven, aren't they?
It's not just people.
We know that these vaccines are made in some kind of goo.
I know there's
that goo comes from animals of some sort.
Well, they say there's a shortage of monkeys right now. For research, there is. And this is where this cloning stuff, bioprinting, and all comes handy.
There you go. Informed consent, boy. I think you should really know the name of the monkey who donated your biofilm for your remedies, your serums.
I'm deeply grateful. I truly am. It's very, very seldom in history have I been so grateful. This is an apocryphal moment in many respects. I'm grateful we get to go through these things. And it kind of ties in with what Joseph Campbell was looking for back when he did his series on the hero's journey.
Heroes of a Thousand Faces.
Yeah, mm-hmm. Yeah. And that at this point in time, what our species needs are some new stories, some new mythologies that we can sink our minds into.
And it tells us who we are, what our Bruce Lipton story, which is that our thoughts guide the body, which is our matter creation machine,
yeah,
and our thoughts guide our creation of matter in all media, right? In our bodies, in our inventions, in our world, and how we integrate our discoveries. These are all coming from our consciousness. And so if we do the work to improve our reality there, the physical reality will follow.
That's right. That's right. And it was Joseph Campbell with Bill Myers, the TV series. Thanks, Gabby. And one of the big stories of today was Star Wars. At the time, the 70s, 80s, 90s, when we were growing up, that was a myth that took us beyond the usual storytelling. And that's what we embraced, is who our mythology. However, there's now another layer unfolding that takes us a little bit more than mm-hmm. Star Wars.
Mm-hmm.
And it involves stuff like the virus and teaching us about who we are in an ecosystem that supports a trillion other species all interacting together.
So you want to have a direct, like, mind-meld communication with the virus?
Well, I think nature is the connection that we have with the virus. Virus is a small part of nature.
So do you think that the virus is female or male?
I think that male and female apply to only some species and not others. You know, it's not a universal trait of the universe, from what I can see.
Uh-huh.
Maybe dualism is. Maybe forces, negative and positive, have the dualistic nature of things. But male and female, I think that there are some species that can create either or be both.
Because I was just wondering if you wanted to refer to it by name so you could engage it, whether you would call it Uncle Virus or Antivirus.
We need both. There are different kinds, right? And they go for different things. And I think there's a whole branch of medicine in, not in the West, but more in like Russia, where they train microbes to go after other microbes in your body.
Wow, sort of like a miniature flea circus.
You know the food chain, you know who eats who, and you just, you know, have the right combinations that you set off.
Well, we are definitely getting down into those realms. I mean, one of the articles you have is a little bit analogous to that. The article about the...
You're talking about the food, the personalized food work that the NIH is financing.
Yes, definitely.
That's fascinating. It looks like our government is going to start exploring what is the perfect diet or food input, I guess, depending on how you look at it, for each of us individually, right? Each person has their own menu of food every mm-hmm. day that is unique to who you are and your bio system.
Right. Yes, completely personalized nutrition.
Right, like personalized medicine. We've been talking about the other side.
So there is no more of this kind of nonsense of one cure fits all. And you go back to where you have a very intimate relationship with your advisor, your health advisor, who knows you and your particular situation and gives you the best remedy for you.
Yeah, and we like that kind of choice. I mean, I like going to a restaurant and being able to choose my own food. And
your own microbiome.
Yeah, and you notice, can you imagine going home and everybody ordering their own dish and having that ability? The bioprinters will allow you to do that. You'll have the freedom of a restaurant at home in another generation.
Well, I was also wanting to talk about this very interesting tiny graphene microchip article that you have here, because, of course, graphene is carbon atoms, and in this case, this is a 15-year-old invention of using the graphene structure of carbon atoms as a source of electrical potential. And the contribution of this article about the graphene microchips is that these very thin atom-sized layers of graphene are being rippled and
folded.
Wrinkled and folded.
Yeah,
and
there's something about
folding,
right?
And so this kind of dappled environment is being found to have electrical properties, and they don't really have mastery of it yet. But that is the micro universe that we are approaching, that we are delving into as the new frontier.
Again, it's reflecting what already is. Our brains are folded material. They maximize space through all this infinite folding that seems to be going on. It increases the amount of surface you have of space. So naturally, we would start to think up ways of using that kind of principle. principle in designing our microprocessing chips.
Right. There may be faster ways of getting places than straight lines. Okay, listen, callers, we will be back after
100
the
times,
break.
100 times faster using folding.
Origami.
Yeah, origami. Yeah, what
be
a
right
concept.
Back.
Hey, welcome back to the show. Yes, that's right. The Power of Myth with Bill Moyers. Bill
Moyers. Yeah.
Right.
Yeah, that was a great series.
One of the great docuseries ever.
George Lucas actually had read Hero of a Thousand Faces, and he realized that we come in an era where we need a new myth, because the old myth was Parsifal. Throughout Middle Ages, the myth was Parsifal, to discover and come out and overcome dragons and the world and everything that way. But now we have to have a new myth, which is Star Wars.
Yes.
But now we need
the next level.
we need the next level now.
Well, we got a lot of new myths coming out. In fact, I'd say we have more new myths to deal with than ever.
Well,
with all of the channels that people are watching and, COVID keeping us in front of our screens, I'd say there are so many new myths that are turning.
Yes, you could be anybody you want to be this time around.
You can be anyone this time around. You can do anything this time around. You're God, baby, and it's your reality. It all comes from you this time around.
We got a caller?
We do. We've had Pablo from Los Gatos patiently waiting. Hello, Pablo.
Hey,
hello.
Pablo. Hey there.
How are you guys doing?
We're
great.
How are you?
Oh, pretty good. I really like to listen to your show, and I like to hear some of your guests, and I often don't call because I don't want to interrupt what they have to say.
Mm.
It's about space and stuff. And Mrs. Future said it herself, the new frontier is actually here. It's small and whatnot.
Mm-hmm.
And I wanted to let you guys know how to measure a year.
Okay. How do we measure a year?
With what?
There's 13 moon cycles, 28 days every year.
Mm-hmm.
It doesn't have to do with us spinning around.
You mean like the Mayan calendar?
That's the Chinese calendar.
Mayan calendar?
Yeah, the lunar year.
Well, Mayan, the Hebrews, Christians.
Lunar.
The Incas. It goes on and on.
That's definitely probably the oldest. I mean, I would say that's the basis of the Chinese and many other calendars. I personally love studying all the different ways people describe time, because you can really see the history of humans trying to make sense of their world and just coming up with ways to interpret what they could observe. And that's definitely a good one. There's nothing that is as constant as the ever-changing moon.
Have you ever heard of the Antikythera mechanism?
No, what is that?
It's an ancient Greek hand-powered mechanism with lots of gears that's an olden example of a device that was used for predicting astronomical positions and eclipses for calendar astrological purposes.
Yeah, you might want to Google it, because...
Do you know how to measure years?
Yeah, it could track 4-year cycles of athletic games as well for the ancient Greek games.
Yeah, it was tracking the Olympics back in the day, a few thousand years ago.
Yeah, and it was the only one.
How about the star trails doing circles in the sky when you visit?
Yeah, the retrograde motion is definitely one of the things that was also being tracked, and the different planetary motions when they thought of them as the wandering stars.
Right. Yeah, wandering stars. That's what Mars is. Star of war.
Well, that's our interpretation of it.
Well, it sure looks like it got beat up by the rest of the planets, doesn't it? It's got that big crack in it.
The heliocentric model is basically a cult.
Well, I wouldn't go that far.
Really? Is it a cult that you're in? Are you in the cult, Pablo?
Hold on.
Cult of reality?
Nobody knows that they're in a cult. They're just
doing it. This reality seems real to me.
Do you think a cult is smaller than a culture?
I don't know.
Well, one begets the other, don't they, Mrs. Future? I mean...
Well, I just think they're related.
But if you can create one, you can dissolve it, too.
You know, you could see the northern star in the southern hemisphere.
Really?
Yeah.
Never tried. That sounds like
depends,
a good thing to do.
It depends on the model of Earth that you have, I would say.
Right. Well, no, you could go down to Peru and you could see the northern star.
Yeah.
Oh, that's cool. All right. Well, thank you, Pablo. You want to share any other star knowledge? before we head out to the next
article?
No,
that's all. I'll just let the people think about that one.
Yeah, okay.
Good. Thanks. Right. Good to hear from you.
All right, thanks for calling. Bye.
Yeah, I think if you get below the Tropic of Capricorn,
yeah,
or, you know, in the Southern Hemisphere, then you can't see it.
Mm-hmm.
Like, you know, obviously, if you're at the South Pole, you cannot see the North Star.
Yeah. Wow.
It's just not possible. But at Peru, you can. Below the equator, yes, you can.
Well, wherever you are on the planet, I don't know what the arc is of the sky that you can see, but it's more than 180.
Why would it be that? Because you're so high? You're up in the Peru and the mountaintops that you'd be able to see the Northern Star in the Southern Hemisphere?
Just think of it. You know, I've been to Southern India, which is very close to the equator.
Yeah.
And yes, I could see the Magellanic Cloud, which I'd never seen before here, up here. There are parts of the star systems that you don't see when you go further south. But I could still see the North Star, but it was just very, very low north.
On the horizon.
Yeah, very low. Yeah.
So and the further south you go, the closer the North Star gets to the horizon.
That's right.
Yeah.
And it disappears.
And I think our caller was also referring to the idea that we're not just heliocentric. We're just not going in circles around each other. They're more oblong. And they're also traveling through space and time themselves. So the whole thing is hurtling around the galaxy.
Yeah, I remember my delight when, through the advances in computer animation, people started representing the galaxy instead of as planets in circles going around the sun.
Yeah,
they started representing it as a vortex of a bunch of planets that were like
spiraling
after the sun, and the sun was scooting forward, going around the black hole in the center of the galaxy, and the planets were chasing the sun.
Spiraling through the galaxy, leaving an after image.
Yeah. So.
Yeah, very, very distinct. Very easy to do cinematically, I might add.
Mm-hmm.
And yet very instructive, because it gives you more of a feeling of what forces are acting upon ourselves at this very minute. That we actually are hurtling around not just the solar system, or not just circling around that, but the galaxy, and the galaxy itself is going around.
Yeah, we have a tiny little cult that we believe is a certain amount of stillness and stability around us, but actually that's just a bubble that's moving faster than we can imagine inside of a much larger universe.
And yet, these are like forces. They're like invisible, like gravity. Mm-hmm. And such. These are forces from the larger universe that are actually acting on us all the time. That are normal, that we're just part of who we are.
Well, and it's analogous to the atoms that are in the middle of our fingers at the tip of our nerves. And if you move your hand from down to up, if you touch your head, that would be the equivalent of a planet crossing through a galaxy.
Yeah, microcosm, macrocosm.
Right.
It's all the same. Thank God. I get confused otherwise.
Right. It's all relative.
Back to the food. Back to the food. To be able to create perfect steaks without killing animals, huge.
Mm-hmm.
Okay. Not just for the spiritual reason for saving millions of lives a year of animals, but not even breeding them.
Mm-hmm.
All right. And
so in the future, humans will not get jobs as burger flippers. They'll get jobs as food flavorers. Everybody will be making these cruelty-free things taste great.
They'll get better at tasting, yes.
While the menial jobs will be given to the robots.
But I'm also saying we'll have more variability, too. Why stick with beef? I'd like to try zebra.
Well, they have chicken.
Chicken. Okay. But if it doesn't matter, there's the trillion species on this planet. It's all part of the food chain in various ways. And including us.
So you'll keep a vast repository of a variety start cells
recipes. And I think it would evolve our taste sense so that we'd start tasting more and more interesting things as we evolve. Mm. Life tends to get more complexity and more aesthetic.
Mm. It's like trying foods from a different country, like whether it's sushi or Indian food or
Chinese food. From a different Petri dish.
Yeah. It's like those early perfumers in France, where they would discover these different perfumes and actually sell them as a new thing to smell. It becomes very popular. So I think we're stuck on hamburgers, but I think we can move away from there and explore.
Explore more choices.
Yeah. Maybe it could be sushi, you know? Maybe synthetic sushi might be palatable. Yeah.
Sure. I bet the fish would like that.
I guess it opens up the question, if you could eat anything, what would you?
Smoothies.
smoothies.
Isn't that what Arthur C. Clarke said? If we found...
Who needs a mouth?
His saying was, if we went to another planet and we found beings that were less intelligent than we were, we would probably eat it.
See it on the food chain.
Yeah.
That would be exotic, right?
If they didn't eat us first.
Yeah.
Well, yeah.
All right, we got to go to a break. Let's digest that for a few minutes, and then we'll be back with the last few minutes of Dr. Future.
I sold my microbiome on this. Welcome back to the show. NBC News had a great breaking story this last week on how scientists have cloned the first U.S. endangered species. Did you see that?
I did.
No.
It's a very really cute little ferret.
Yeah, a little black-footed ferret was duplicated from genes of an animal that died more than 30 years ago. Yeah, so...
They just dug him up from the pet cemetery and...
Yeah, Pet Sematary. I haven't seen that movie yet. I almost have a couple of times, but I just can't quite bring myself there.
Oh, I see the picture of the ferret.
Oh, it's cute, really, isn't it?
Is this real? Is this?
Yeah, it's real. It's a real slinky little predator ferret named Elizabeth Ann, born December 10th.
Oh, my God.
Cute as a button. You can see it on our links page. Cute, isn't it?
Yeah.
Yeah.
Turns out nature builds things from stem cells.
Yeah. She's in a genetic copy of a ferret named Willa that died in 1988, and they kept her remains frozen until now. They're thinking that this cloning process seems to work with the ferrets. It could work with other species as well, and maybe even species we can collect the DNA on that we don't have, like the passenger pigeon that died out over 100 years ago.
Isn't this what Jurassic Park was all about?
Well, you know, there are cautionary tales about this, but this is reality, Mrs. Future. That was fiction. Reality is a little bit more multi-layered. But yeah, you're right. It's what Jurassic Park got into, but a little bit more applied to everything rather than just dinosaurs. Mm-hmm. I guess it comes down to getting your favorite pet cloned, right? And or if you're really keeping clone copies of your family, you know, in the event of a car accident. Spare parts, all those things become normalized.
Look at this. Right? You have an article here from Taryn Southern, Meet My AI Clone.
Right.
Right in the same line of thinking here.
Yeah, that's another sci-fi idea.
You can't live forever, but some of your cells can. And they can just keep starting over in a new vat.
As long as you maintain your pattern, right? It's your pattern, right? That's unique in the universe, the particular code of your system.
Mm-hmm. I think the best way to get this is if you have relatives that have passed.
Yeah.
If you can hold on to, if before they're cremated or buried, or actually you can go back if they're buried, and you can get inside the tooth, you can actually extract DNA and clone that.
Yeah, so whatever you can do that for, you can go back that far.
Yes.
Right. It gets really sci-fi horror movie material when you think about it in the sense of, well, that cemeteries would actually be DNA repositories.
Well, and who owns the spare parts, right? Does only the original DNA contributor own the spare parts?
I'm sure glad Uncle Joe decided not to go for the flames, but chose to keep his DNA intact. Now we can clone him.
All right. Well, I vote for no slavery and no cruelty. How's that? And then where we go from there, we can be creative.
Okay, that's fine. That leaves a latitude of having some serious fun with this. We have a caller, Mrs. Future?
We do. Steve from the Santa Cruz Harbor. Hi, Steve.
Hey, Steve.
Hey, guys. They've been having about a 10-day nonstop memorial for Rush Limbaugh, who I enjoyed at times. I definitely enjoyed him.
Yeah.
But they've been building on this memorial, on the talk shows in the morning, the subject matters is what it should be to Rush. I'm convinced they should have just stuffed Rush.
Well, Rush probably will eventually come back virtually because he has so many fans.
They'll be able to create an AI out of all of his thousands of hours of talk.
That's right. They'll mine his best jokes and replay them over and over.
Create a version you'll be proud of.
I think a stuffed Rush would have been, I think he would have gone for it. Hey, and I just wanted to say to the doctor, Dr. Future, I spent a summer reading in Dana Point, and I read Pet Cemetery. It's a long, thick, heavy drone of a book, Tomb of a Book by Stephen King. Mm-hmm. And I got to tell you, it was dark, man. It takes you to some dark places. And That's his job, that's what he does. Yeah, who is that lady that used to write about the vampires, did a whole series of
Anne
them?
Rice.
Really, like Anne Rice actually drove herself kind of mad with that writing at the end. And,
I heard, in fact, I have a friend who told me that she had to do some soul retrieval penance by writing a book about Jesus, and that she did a lot of historical research to kind of redeem her soul.
I don't know if immersing yourself in that, and I'll tell you, Pet Cemetery, I think, is one of his most dark books. It really struck some nerves for me, so I don't want to see the movie. And
I don't like horror movies, but I do remember seeing Pet Cemetery before I stopped watching that kind of thing. Yeah, evil is in the human beings that give it energy, and we sure have a lot of better choices as far as I'm concerned.
Oh, I applaud that, you guys, and I look forward to your next show.
Okay. Yeah, thanks.
Thanks, Steve. Yeah. All right. Yeah.
It begs the question, is that we start to have these scientific abilities of doing things like cloning and having it not just to create other humans, but for creating useful things like lost limbs.
Sure.
From accidents.
Hey,
so would
it
you
serves
like to
the
be
octopus.
Able, I mean, our cars have spare parts.
It'd be
why
really
should
good
bodies?
For us if we could master that.
Yeah.
Of course, it's better to not lose the limb in the first place.
So having these abilities, obviously, I mean, is the direction we want to go, mm-hmm. you know, in terms of health. We can maintain better health this way. All kinds of possibilities arise.
Well, it's very interesting. You have this one article about how there's a liver. The scientists are using a technique, a stem cell technique, to fix damaged livers from lab-grown cells. And so what the Petri dish can facilitate in terms of helping us to regenerate healthy tissue where we need it is really the frontier in medicine right now.
Yeah, regenerative medicine, for sure.
Mm-hmm. Yeah. Spare and parts for
you
your
can
body.
Only you have to understand the entire ecosystem in order to make it work.
Yeah, well, that's why using your own DNA makes a lot of sense, because your body won't reject it, duh.
That's right.
It's obvious in many ways. Now that we have it, it was hard to get that level.
Sure. So instead of the future being full of evil Baron von Harkonnen that are stealing the young spare parts of slave beings, what you have instead is people mining themselves for healthy stem cells and planning ahead for replacing some of those things that are breaking down. The way people are using it now is they're regenerating some of their connective tissue around their sore knees and their sore shoulders and their sore hips. And some people are using it to stay young. Instead of Botox killing off your cells to decrease your wrinkles, they're actually putting stem cells in your face to create fat that make you look younger. Living cells is probably, it's a real Frankenstein kind of movie.
But I think we have to understand
some good
like.
Can come of it.
Yes, a lot could get. Look at this. And these cells like higher level stuff, like music. Thank you, Gabby, for that link from Smart News at the Smithsonian on scientists who play music to cheese as it ages.
That's right. There were apparently some experiments done with 30 different slabs of cheese.
Nonstop loops of Led Zeppelin, A Tribe Called Quest, and Mozart.
These are music.
Cheese wheels.
Music that was played to various cheeses to see how it would taste.
Yeah, as they age, with that complex dance between milk and bacteria. And they got literally ballroom dances from our music. And they got results. It was kind of neat.
What did they prefer? Which of the music did they prefer?
Well, it depends on the cheese. You know, each cheese has an individual taste. For 6 months, they were exposed to endless 24-hour loops of one song or another, one group
and
or another.
And the big conclusion is hip-hop music makes cheese taste funkier.
No, that's deep research. Well, they had a control cheese that aged in silence. Uh-huh. Okay, caller? Okay, let's go to the caller.
All right.
Okay.
Mr. Blanco in Capitola, how are you?
Yes. Is it true if I drink enough Coca-Cola, I can become less white?
First I've heard. You'll have to try it and report back.
Yeah. Turn on your camera. Oh. Put it on time-lapse.
I think he was funning us. Yeah, he got off the line pretty quick.
Yeah. Actually, yeah, go ahead, Bobby.
I was just going to say, we're coming up to the end of the show.
Yes.
Yeah.
And I just wanted to mention one thing. Go to the links page. Mm-hmm. Look at the last one, which is on solar window. Uh-huh. I think this is going to revolutionize how we gather energy for cars, airplanes.
Oh, I totally agree. It's so great.
Windows as solar collectors, and they're still transparent.
That's right.
Yes.
So they're coming up with materials that can collect solar power and can be used in all kinds of manufacturing. So we don't need heavy solar panels. We can put solar film on surfaces everywhere.
Everything's generating power.
Very cool.
It's closer
idea.
To Tesla's idea of very decentralized cool. energy sources.
Right. Well, on that note, everybody, what a fun week it has been. And I hope that your spring is looking up. And
yes, and Richard, thanks. Yeah, saving umbilical cords is part of the smart birth process now.
Yeah,
save
you
those.
Do that.
Yes. Save
that's
those umbilical
your best
cords.
Stem cells ever, huh?
That's right. Yes. It could be useful to your health in the future.
All right. This is
all right.
Dr.
Thanks
Future
for listening.
Show on KSCO, Santa Cruz, San Jose, Salinas, Monterey, Venus,
Mars. Don't forget Mars.
Mars.
We're there. Mars.